fears almost accidentally. We're not talking about someone who sold Girl Scout cookies. My student was an experienced fundraiser who regularly got donors to pony up $1,000 to $25,000 a check. Over the years, she'd developed a very successful system to get her clients, usually wealthy women, to open their checkbook. She'd invite a potential donor to her office, serve a few Girl Scout cookies, walk her through an album of heartwarming snapshots and handwritten letters from projects that matched the woman's profile, and then collect a check when the donor's eyes lit up. It was almost easy. One day, though, she met the immovable donor. Once the woman sat down in her office, my student began to throw out the projects her research had said would fit. But the woman shook her head at one project after another. My student found herself growing perplexed at the difficult donor who had no interest in donating. But she held her emotion in check and reached back to a lesson from my recent class on labeling. "I'm sensing some hesitation with these projects," she said in what she hoped was a level voice. As if she'd been uncorked, the woman exclaimed, "I want my gift to directly support programming for Girl Scouts and not anything else." This helped focus the conversation, but as my student put forth project after project that seemed to fulfill the donor's criteria, all she got was still rejection. Sensing the potential donor's growing frustration and wanting to end on a positive note so that they might be able to meet again, my student used another label. "It seems that you are really passionate about this gift and want to find the right project reflecting the opportunities and life-changing experiences the Girl Scouts gave you." And with that, this difficult woman signed a check without even picking a specific project. "You understand me," she said as she got up to leave. "I trust you'll find the right project." Fear of her money being misappropriated was the presenting dynamic that the first label uncovered. But the second label uncovered the underlying dynamic. Her very presence in the office was driven by very specific memories of being a little Girl Scout and how it changed her life. The obstacle here wasn't finding the right match for the woman. It wasn't that she was this highly finicky, hard-to-please donor. The real obstacle was that this woman needed to feel that she was understood, that the person handling her money knew why she was in that office and understood the memories that were driving her actions. That's why labels are so powerful and so potentially transformative to the state of any conversation. By digging beneath what seems like a mountain of quibbles, details, and logistics, labels help to uncover and identify the primary emotion driving almost all of your counterpart's behavior, the emotion that, once acknowledged, seems to miraculously solve everything else. Do an accusation audit. On the first day of negotiating class each semester, I march the group through an introductory exercise called 60 Seconds or She Dies. I play a hostage taker, and a student has to convince me to release my hostage within a minute. It's an icebreaker that shows me the level of my students, and it reveals to them how much they need to learn. Here's a little secret. The hostage never gets out. Sometimes students jump right in, but finding takers is usually hard because it means coming to the front of the class and competing with the guy who holds all the cards. If I just ask for a volunteer, my students sit on their hands and look away. You've been there. You can almost feel your back muscles tense as you think, "Oh, please, don't call on me." So I don't ask. Instead, I say, "In case you're worried about volunteering to role-play with me in front of the class, I want to tell you in advance. It's going to be horrible." After the laughter dies down, I then say, "And those of you who do volunteer will probably get more out of this than anyone else." I always end up with more volunteers than I need. Now, look at what I did. I prefaced the conversation by labeling my audience's fears. How much worse can something be than horrible? I diffuse them and wait, letting it sink in and thereby making the unreasonable seem less forbidding. All of us have intuitively done something close to this thousands of times. You'll start a criticism of a friend by saying, "I don't want this to sound harsh," hoping that whatever comes next will be softened. Or you'll say, "I don't want to seem like an asshole," hoping your counterpart will tell you a few sentences later that you're not that bad. The small but critical mistake this commits is denying the negative. That actually gives it credence. In court, defense lawyers do this properly by mentioning everything their client is accused of and all the weaknesses of their case in the opening statement. They call this technique taking the sting out. What I want to do here is turn this into a process that, applied systematically, you can use to disarm your counterpart while negotiating everything from your son's bedtime to large business contracts. The first step of doing so is listing every terrible thing your counterpart could say about you in what I call an accusation audit. This idea of an accusation audit is really, really hard for people to get their minds around. The first time I tell my students about it, they say, "Oh my God, we can't do that." It seems both artificial and self-loathing. It seems like it would make things worse. But then I remind them that it's exactly what I did the first day of class when I labeled their fears of the hostage game in advance. And they all admit that none of them knew. As an example, I'm going to use the experience of one of my students, Anna, because I couldn't be more proud at how she turned what she learned in my class into $1 million. At the time, Anna was representing a major government contractor. Her firm had won a competition for a sizable government deal by partnering with a small company, let's call it ABC Corp, whose CEO had a close relationship with a government client representative. Problems started right after they won the contract, though. Because ABC's relationship had been instrumental in winning the deal, ABC felt that it was owed a piece of the pie, whether it fulfilled its part of the contract or not. And so, while the contract paid them for the work of 9 people, they continually cut back support. As Anna's company had to perform ABC's work, the relationship between ABC and Anna's company fragmented into vituperative emails and bitter complaining. Facing an already low profit margin, Anna's company was forced into tough negotiations to get ABC to take a cut to 5.5 people. The negotiations left a bitter aftertaste on both sides. The vituperative emails stopped, but then again, all emails stopped. And no communication is always a bad sign. A few months after those painful talks, the client demanded a major rethink on the project, and Anna's firm was faced with losing serious money if it didn't get ABC to agree to further cuts. Because ABC wasn't living up to its side of the bargain, Anna's firm would have had strong contractual grounds to cut out ABC altogether. But that would have damaged Anna's firm's reputation with a very important customer, and could have led to litigation from ABC. Faced with this scenario, Anna set up a meeting with ABC where she and her partners planned to inform ABC that its pay was being cut to 3 people. It was a touchy situation, as ABC was already unhappy about the first cut. Even though she was normally an aggressive and confident negotiator, worries about the negotiations ruined Anna's sleep for weeks. She needed to extract concessions while improving the relationship at the same time. No easy task, right? To prepare, the first thing Anna did was sit down with her negotiating partner, Mark, and list every negative charge that ABC could level at them. The relationship had gone sour long before, so the list was huge. But the biggest possible accusations were easy to spot. You are the typical prime contractor trying to force out the small guy. You promised us we would have all this work, and you reneged on your promise. You could have told us about this issue weeks ago to help us prepare. Anna and Mark then took turns role-playing the two sides, with one playing ABC and the other disarming these accusations with anticipatory labels. "You're going to think we are a big, bad prime contractor when we are done," Anna practiced saying slowly and naturally. "It seems you feel this work was promised to you from the beginning," Mark said. They trained in front of an observer, honing their pacing, deciding at what point they would label each fear, and planning when to include meaningful pauses. It was theater. When the day of the meeting arrived, Anna opened by acknowledging ABC's biggest gripes. "We understand that we brought you on board with the shared goal of having you lead this work," she said. "You may feel like we have treated you unfairly and that we changed the deal significantly since then. We acknowledge that you believe you were promised this work." This received an emphatic nod from the ABC representatives, so Anna continued by outlining the situation in a way that encouraged the ABC reps to see the firms as teammates, peppering her statements with open-ended questions that showed she was listening. "What else is there you feel is important to add to this?" By labeling the fears and asking for input, Anna was able to elicit an important fact about ABC's fears, namely that ABC was expecting this to be a high-profit contract because it thought Anna's firm was doing quite well from the deal. This provided an entry point for Mark, who explained that the client's new demands had turned his firm's profits into losses, meaning that he and Anna needed to cut ABC's pay further to three people. Angela, one of ABC's representatives, gasped. "It sounds like you think we are the big bad prime contractor trying to push out the small business," Anna said, heading off the first accusation before it could be made. "No, no, we don't think that," Angela said, conditioned by the acknowledgement to look for common ground. With the negatives labeled and the worst accusations laid bare, Anna and Mark were able to turn the conversation to the contract. Watch what they do closely, as it's brilliant. They acknowledge ABC's situation while simultaneously shifting the onus of offering a solution to the smaller company. "It sounds like you have a great handle on how the government contract should work," Anna said, labeling Angela's expertise. "Yes, but I know that's not how it always goes," Angela answered, proud to have her experience acknowledged. Anna then asked Angela how she would amend the contract so that everyone made some money, which pushed Angela to admit that she saw no way to do so without cutting ABC's worker count. Several weeks later, the contract was tweaked to cut ABC's payout, which brought Anna's company $1 million that put the contract into the black. But it was Angela's reaction at the end of the meeting that most surprised Anna. After Anna had acknowledged that she had given Angela some bad news and that she understood how angry she must feel, Angela said, "This is not a good situation, but we appreciate the fact that you are acknowledging what happened, and we don't feel like you are mistreating us. And you are not the big bad prime." Anna's reaction to how this turned out? Holy crap! This stuff actually works! She's right. As you just saw, the beauty of going right after negativity is that it brings us to a safe zone of empathy. Every one of us has an inherent human need to be understood, to connect with the person across the table. That explains why, after Anna labeled Angela's fears, Angela's first instinct was to add nuance and detail to those fears. And that detail gave Anna the power to accomplish what she wanted from the negotiation. Get a seat and an upgrade on a sold-out flight. Up to this point, we've been building each skill as if they were musical instruments. First try the saxophone mirror. Now here's the bass label. And finally, why don't you blow a note on the French horn of tactical silence? But in a real negotiation, the band all plays together, so you've got to learn how to conduct. Keeping all the instruments playing is really awkward for most people. It seems to go by in such a rush. So what I'm going to do here is play a song at slow speed so you can hear each instrument note by note. I promise you'll quickly see how the skills you have been building play off one another, rising, riffing, falling, and pausing in perfect harmony. Here is the situation, the song, if you will. My student, Ryan B., was flying from Baltimore to Austin to sign a large computer consulting contract. For 6 months, the client representative had gone back and forth on whether he wanted the services, but a major system collapse put the representative in a tight spot with his CEO. To shift the blame, he called Ryan with his CEO on the line and very aggressively demanded to know why it was taking Ryan so long to come ink the contract. If Ryan was not there by Friday morning, he said, the deal was off. Ryan bought a ticket for the next morning, Thursday, but a freak lightning storm whipped up in Baltimore, closing the airport for 5 hours. It became painfully clear that Ryan wasn't going to make his original connection to Austin from Dallas. Worse, when he called American Airlines just before departing, he found that his connection had been automatically rebooked to 3 p.m. the next day, putting the contract in jeopardy. When Ryan finally got to Dallas at 8 p.m., he ran to the gate where the day's final American Airlines flight to Austin was less than 30 minutes from takeoff. His goal was to get on that flight or, at worst, get an earlier flight the next day. In front of him at the gate, a very aggressive couple was yelling at the gate agent, who was barely looking at them as she tapped on the computer in front of her. She was clearly making every effort not to scream back. After she'd said, "There's nothing I can do," 5 times, the angry couple finally gave up and left. To start, Watch how Ryan turns that heated exchange to his advantage. Following on the heels of an argument is a great position for a negotiator because your counterpart is desperate for an empathetic connection. Smile, and you're already an improvement. Hi, Wendy. I'm Ryan. It seems like they were pretty upset. This labels the negative and establishes a rapport based on empathy. This in turn encourages Wendy to elaborate on her situation. Words Ryan then mirrors to invite her to go further. Yeah, they missed their connection. We've had a fair amount of delays because of the weather. The weather? After Wendy explains how the delays in the Northeast had rippled through the system, Ryan again labels the negative and then mirrors her answer to encourage her to delve further. It seems like it's been a hectic day. There've been a lot of irate customers, you know? I mean, I get it, even though I don't like to be yelled at. A lot of people are trying to get to Austin for the big game. The big game? UT is playing Ole Miss in football, and every flight into Austin has been booked solid. Booked solid? Now let's pause. Up to this point, Ryan has been using labels and mirrors to build a relationship with Wendy. To her, it must seem like idle chatter, though, because he hasn't asked for anything. Unlike the angry couple, Ryan is acknowledging her situation. His words ping-pong between what's that and I hear you, both of which invite her to elaborate. Now that the empathy has been built, she lets slip a piece of information he can use. Yeah, all through the weekend. Though who knows how many people will make the flights. The weather's probably going to reroute a lot of people through a lot of different places. Here's where Ryan finally swoops in with an ask. But notice how he acts, not assertive or coldly logical, but with empathy and labeling that acknowledges her situation and tacitly puts them in the same boat. Well, it seems like you've been handling the rough day pretty well, he says. I was also affected by the weather delays and missed my connecting flight. It seems like this flight is likely booked solid, but with what you said, maybe someone affected by the weather might miss this connection. Is there any possibility a seat will be open? Listen to that riff. Label, tactical empathy, label, and only then a request. At this point, Wendy says nothing and begins typing on her computer. Ryan, who's eager not to talk himself out of a possible deal, engages in some silence. After 30 seconds, Wendy prints a boarding pass and hands it to Ryan, explaining that there were a few seats that were supposed to be filled by people who would now arrive much later than the flight's departure. To make Ryan's success even better, she puts him in Economy Plus seating. All that in under 2 minutes. The next time you find yourself following an angry customer at a corner store or airplane line, take a moment and practice labels and mirrors on the service person. I promise they won't scream, "Don't try to control me," and burst into flames. And you might walk away with a little more than you expected. Key lessons. As you try to insert the tools of tactical empathy into your daily life, I encourage you to think of them as extensions of natural human interactions and not artificial conversational tics. In any interaction, it pleases us to feel that the other side is listening and acknowledging our situation. Whether you are negotiating a business deal or simply chatting to the person at the supermarket butcher counter, creating an empathetic relationship and encouraging your counterpart to expand on their situation is the basis of healthy human interaction. These tools, then, are nothing less than emotional best practices that help you cure the pervasive ineptitude that marks our most critical conversations in life. They will help you connect and create more meaningful and warm relationships. That they might help you extract what you want is a bonus. Human connection is the first goal. With that in mind, I encourage you to take the risk of sprinkling these in every conversation you have. I promise you that they will feel awkward and artificial at first, but keep at it. Learning to walk felt awkwardly strange, too. As you internalize these techniques, turning the artifice of tactical empathy into a habit, and then into an integral part of your personality, keep in mind these lessons from the chapter you've just read. Imagine yourself in your counterpart's situation. The beauty of empathy is that it doesn't demand that you agree with the other person's ideas. You may well find them crazy. But by acknowledging the other person's situation, you immediately convey that you are listening. And once they know that you are listening, they may tell you something that you can use. The reasons why a counterpart will not make an agreement with you are often more powerful than why they will make a deal. So focus first on clearing the barriers to agreement. Denying barriers or negative influences gives them credence. Get them into the open. Pause. After you label a barrier or mirror a statement, let it sink in. Don't worry. The other party will fill the silence. Label your counterpart's fears to diffuse their power. We all want to talk about the happy stuff, but remember, the faster you interrupt action in your counterpart's amygdala, the part of the brain that generates fear, the faster you can generate feelings of safety, well-being, and trust. List the worst things that the other party could say about you and say them before the other person can. Performing an accusation audit in advance prepares you to head off negative dynamics before they take root. And because these accusations often sound exaggerated when said aloud, speaking them will encourage the other person to claim that quite the opposite is true. Remember, you're dealing with a person who wants to be appreciated and understood. So use labels to reinforce and encourage positive perceptions and dynamics. Chapter 4. Beware, yes. Master, no. Let me paint a scenario we've all experienced. You're at home, just before dinner, and the phone rings. It is, no surprise, a telemarketer. He wants to sell you magazine subscriptions, water filters, frozen Argentine beef. To be honest, it doesn't matter, as the script is always the same. After butchering your name and engaging in some disingenuous pleasantries, he launches into his pitch. The hard sell that comes next is a scripted flowchart designed to cut off your escape routes as it funnels you down a path with no exit but yes. Do you enjoy a nice glass of water from time to time? Well, yes, but me too. And like me, I bet you like crisp, clean water with no chemical aftertaste, like Mother Nature made it. Well, yes, but who is this guy with a fake smile in his voice, you wonder, who thinks he can trick you into buying something you don't want? You feel your muscles tighten, your voice go defensive, and your heart rate accelerate. You feel like his prey, and you are. The last thing you want to do is say yes, even when it's the only way to answer, do you drink water? Compromise and concession, even to the truth, feels like defeat. And no, well, no feels like salvation, like an oasis. You're tempted to use no when it's blatantly untrue just to hear its sweet sound. No, I do not need water, carbon-filtered or otherwise. I'm a camel. Now let's think about this selling technique. It's designed to get to yes at all costs, as if no were death. And for many of us, it is. We have all these negative connotations with no. We talk about the rejection of no, about the fear of hearing it. No is the ultimate negative word. But at the end of the day, yes is often a meaningless answer that hides deeper objections, and maybe is even worse. Pushing hard for yes doesn't get a negotiator any closer to a win. It just angers the other side. So if yes can be so damn uncomfortable, and no such a relief, why have we fetishized one and demonized the other? We have it backward. For good negotiators, no is pure gold. That negative provides a great opportunity for you and the other party to clarify what you really want, by eliminating what you don't want. No is a safe choice that maintains the status quo. It provides a temporary oasis of control. At some point in their development, all negotiators have to come to grips with no. When you come to realize the real psychological dynamic behind it, you'll love the word. It's not just that you lose your fear of it, but that you come to learn what it does for you and how you can build deals out of it. Yes and maybe are often worthless, but no always alters the conversation. No starts the negotiation. My fascination with no in all its beautiful nuance began with a conversation I had a few months before my negotiation career began. I started my career with the Bureau as a member of the FBI SWAT team in the Pittsburgh division, but after nearly 2 years I was transferred to New York, where the FBI attached me to the Joint Terrorism Task Force, JTTF. It was an amazing post. We spent our days and nights tracking suspected terrorists, investigating their cells, and assessing whether or how they might strike. We were untying knots of human anger in the midst of America's biggest city, making life-and-death decisions on who was dangerous and who was just blowing hot air. The work fascinated me. Ever since my first days with the Bureau, I had been obsessed with crisis response. The immediacy of the task enthralled me. The stakes were high. Lives hung in the balance. The emotional terrain was complex, changing, and often conflicting. To successfully gain a hostage's safe release, a negotiator had to penetrate the hostage taker's motives, state of mind, intelligence, and emotional strengths and weaknesses. The negotiator played the role of bully, conciliator, enforcer, savior, confessor, instigator, and peacemaker. And that's just a few of the parts. I thought I was cut out for every one of them. A few weeks after I got to Manhattan, I showed up at the desk of Amy Bondereau, who ran the FBI's crisis negotiation team in New York. I didn't know beans about negotiating, so I went for the direct approach. "I want to be a hostage negotiator," I said. "Everyone does. Got any training?" she asked. "No," I said. "Any credentials?" "Nope," I answered. "Any experience?" she asked. "No," I answered. "Do you have a degree in psychology, sociology, anything at all related to negotiation?" "Nope." "Looks like you answered your own question," she said. "No. Now go away." "Go away?" I protested. "Really?" "Yep. As in, leave me alone. Everybody wants to be a hostage negotiator, and you have no resume, experience, or skills. So what would you say in my position?" "You got it. No." I paused in front of her, thinking, this is not how my negotiating career ends. I had stared down terrorists. I wasn't going to just leave. "Come on," I said. "There has to be something I can do." Amy shook her head and gave one of those ironic laughs that mean the person doesn't think you've got a snowball's chance in hell. "I'll tell you what. Yes, there is something you can do. Volunteer at a suicide hotline. Then come talk to me." "No guarantees, got it?" she said. "Now seriously, go away." My conversation with Amy kicked off my awareness of the complex and hidden subtleties of conversation, the power of certain words, the seemingly unintelligible emotional truths that so often underlie intelligible exchanges. A trap into which many fall is to take what other people say literally. I started to see that while people played the game of conversation, it was in the game beneath the game, where few played, that all the leverage lived. In our chat, I saw how the word no, so apparently clear and direct, really wasn't so simple. Over the years, I've thought back repeatedly to that conversation, replaying how Amy so quickly turned me down again and again. But her no's were just the gateway to yes. They gave her and me time to pivot, adjust, and re-examine, and actually created the environment for the one yes that mattered. When assigned to the JTTF, I worked with an NYPD lieutenant named Martin. He had a hard shell, and whenever asked for anything, he responded with a terse negative. After I'd gotten to know him a bit, I asked him why. "Chris," he said proudly, "a lieutenant's job is to say no." At first, I thought that sort of automated response signaled a failure of imagination. But then I realized I did the same thing with my teenage son, and that after I'd said no to him, I often found that I was open to hearing what he had to say. That's because, having protected myself, I could relax and more easily consider the possibilities. No is the start of the negotiation, not the end of it. We've been conditioned to fear the word no, but it is a statement of perception far more often than of fact. It seldom means I have considered all the facts and made a rational choice. Instead, no is often a decision, frequently temporary, to maintain the status quo. Change is scary, and no provides a little protection from that scariness. Jim Camp, in his excellent book, Start With No, counsels the reader to give their adversary, his word for counterpart, permission to say no from the outset of a negotiation. He calls it the right to veto. He observes that people will fight to the death to preserve their right to say no, so give them that right, and the negotiating environment becomes more constructive and collaborative almost immediately. When I read Camp's book, I realized this was something we'd known as hostage negotiators for years. We'd learned that the quickest way to get a hostage taker out was to take the time to talk them out, as opposed to demanding their surrender. Demanding their surrender, telling them to come out, always ended up creating a much longer standoff and occasionally actually contributed to death. It comes down to the deep and universal human need for autonomy. People need to feel in control. When you preserve a person's autonomy by clearly giving them permission to say no to your ideas, the emotions calm, the effectiveness of the decisions go up, and the other party can really look at your proposal. They're allowed to hold it in their hands, to turn it around, and it gives you time to elaborate or pivot in order to convince your counterpart that the change you're proposing is more advantageous than the status quo. Great negotiators seek no because they know that's often when the real negotiation begins. Politely saying no to your opponent, we'll go into this in more depth in Chapter 9, calmly hearing no and just letting the other side know that they are welcome to say no, has a positive impact on any negotiation. In fact, your invitation for the other side to say no has an amazing power to bring down barriers and allow for beneficial communication. This means you have to train yourself to hear no as something other than rejection and respond accordingly. When someone tells you no, you need to rethink the word in one of its alternative and much more real meanings. I am not yet ready to agree. You are making me feel uncomfortable. I do not understand. I don't think I can afford it. I want something else. I need more information, or I want to talk it over with someone else. Then, after pausing, ask solution-based questions, or simply label their effect. What about this doesn't work for you? What would you need to make it work? It seems like there's something here that bothers you. People have a need to say no, so don't just hope to hear it at some point. Get them to say it early. Persuade in their world. I'd like to present you with a guy named Joe Businessman as he readies himself for a negotiation. You've met him before. He's the prepared type, with all his getting-to-yes strategies written out and memorized, and he's more than ready to unleash them on the guy across the table. Joe pauses to look at his expensive suit in the mirror, fantasizes about the impressive things he'll say and the fancy charts and graphs that'll back up those things, and leave his counterpart, his opponent, vanquished and in defeat. He is Russell Crowe in Gladiator. He is the man. Now allow me to let you in on a secret. None of that preparation will mean a damn thing. His negotiation style is all me, 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 ego, ego, ego. And when the people on the other side of the table pick up those signals, they're going to decide that it's best to politely, even furtively, ignore this Superman by saying yes. Huh? You say? Sure. The word they'll say right off is yes, but that word is only a tool to get this blowhard to go away. They'll weasel out later, claiming changing conditions, budget issues, the weather. For now, they just want to be released, because Joe isn't convincing them of anything. He's only convincing himself. I'll let you in on a secret. There are actually three kinds of yes: counterfeit, confirmation, and commitment. A counterfeit yes is one in which your counterpart plans on saying no, but either feels yes is an easier escape route, or just wants to disingenuously keep the conversation going to obtain more information or some other kind of edge. A confirmation yes is generally innocent, a reflexive response to a black or white question. It's sometimes used to lay a trap, but mostly it's just simple affirmation with no promise of action. And a commitment yes is the real deal. It's a true agreement that leads to action, a yes at the table that ends up with a signature on the contract. The commitment, yes, is what you want. But the three types sound almost the same, so you have to learn how to recognize which one is being used. Human beings the world over are so used to being pursued for the commitment, yes, as a condition to find out more, that they have become masters at giving the counterfeit yes. That's what the people facing Joe businessmen are doing, dangling the counterfeit yes so they can hear more. Whether you call it buy-in or engagement or something else, good negotiators know that their job isn't to put on a great performance, but to gently guide their counterpart to discover their goal as his own. Let me tell you, I learned that the hard way. 2 months after talking with Amy, I started answering phones for Helpline, a crisis hotline founded by Norman Vincent Peale. The basic rule was that you couldn't be with anybody on the phone for more than 20 minutes. If you did your job, it wasn't going to take you longer than that to get them to a better place. We had a thick book of organizations we referred them to for help. It was a paramedic approach. Patch them up and send them on their way. But people in crisis only accounted for about 40% of the calls we got. The majority of the calls came from frequent callers. These are highly dysfunctional people, energy vampires whom no one else would listen to anymore. We kept a list of frequent callers, and when you got one, the first thing you had to do was check to see if the person had called that day because they were only allowed one call a day. They knew it, too. A lot of times they'd say, "Yeah, I'm Eddie. I haven't called yet today. Go ahead and check the list. You gotta talk to me." Since I was there primarily to learn a skill, I loved the frequent callers. They were a problem, and I loved trying to figure them out. I felt I had some talent at it. I felt like a superstar. When it came time for my performance review, they assigned me a shift supervisor named Jim Snyder. Jim was a hotline veteran and a sweetheart. The only problem was he always wanted to joke around. Jim understood that volunteer burnout was the biggest problem at a hotline, so he dedicated his time to making work fun. I became good friends with Jim. For my review, Jim waited until I got a call and went into the monitoring room where the supervisors could listen to our calls. The call was from one of my frequent clients, a cabbie with a fear of going outside and plenty of time to tell me about it. This energy vampire, his name was Darrow, launched into his shtick about how he was going to lose his house and with it his will to live if he couldn't work. "Seriously, when was the last time someone tried to hurt you on the streets?" I asked. "Well, I mean, it's been a long time," Darrow said. "Like, I can't really remember a date, Chris. Maybe a year, I guess." "So it's safe to say that the outside world hasn't been too hard on you, right?" "Yes," Darrow said. "I suppose so." We went back and forth like this for a while as I made him admit that most of us had little to fear in the world. I was feeling good about my new skills, about listening to Darrow and then care-fronting him, which was the slightly goofy name we gave to assertively, but caringly, responding to frequent callers. It was all flowing, and our rapport was great. I even got Darrow to laugh a few times. By the time I was done with him, he couldn't give me one reason not to step outside. "Thank you, Chris," Darrow said just before he hung up. "Thanks for doing such a great job." Before I went to see Jim, I leaned back in my chair and basked in that compliment. How often do you get that from a man in pain, I thought. Then I sprung up and strode toward the monitoring room, so proud I was practically buffing my nails on my shirt and patting my own back. Jim motioned me to the chair in front of him and gave me his biggest smile. I must have returned it with twice the wattage. "Well, Chris," he said, still smiling, "that was one of the worst calls I ever heard." I stared at Jim, gape-jawed. "Jim, did you hear Darrow congratulate me?" I asked. "I talked him down, man. I killed it." Jim smiled. I hated that smile right then, and nodded. "That's one of the signs, because they should be congratulating themselves when they get off the line," he said. "They don't need to be congratulating you." "That tells me you did too much. If they think you did it, if you were the guy who killed it, how is he going to help himself? I don't want to be harsh, but you were horrible." As I listened to what Jim said, I felt that acid stomach rush you get when you are forced to accept that the guy dumping on you is completely right. Daryl's response had been a kind of yes, but it had been anything but a true commitment yes. He'd made no promise to action. His yes had been designed to make me feel good enough to leave him alone. Daryl may not have known it, but his yes was as counterfeit as they came. You see, that whole call had been about me and my ego and not the caller. But the only way to get these callers to take action was to have them own the conversation, to believe that they were coming to these conclusions, to these necessary steps, and that the voice at the other end was simply a medium for those realizations. Using all your skills to create rapport, agreement, and connection with a counterpart is useful, but ultimately, that connection is useless unless the other person feels that they are equally as responsible, if not solely responsible, for creating the connection and the new ideas they have. I nodded slowly. The fight drained out of me. "One of the worst calls?" I said to Jim. "That's right." I worked hard at reorienting myself from that point on. I asked so many questions and read so much about it that soon they had me teaching two classes for new volunteers at Helpline. The opening class, on active listening, and the one on carefrontation. "Got it," you say. "It's not about me. We need to persuade from their perspective, not ours." But how? By starting with their most basic wants. In every negotiation, in every agreement, the result comes from someone else's decision. And sadly, if we believe that we can control or manage others' decisions with compromise and logic, we're leaving millions on the table. But while we can't control others' decisions, we can influence them by inhabiting their world and seeing and hearing exactly what they want. Though the intensity may differ from person to person, you can be sure that everyone you meet is driven by two primal urges, the need to feel safe and secure, and the need to feel in control. If you satisfy those drives, you're in the door. As we saw with my chat with Daryl, you're not going to logically convince them that they're safe, secure, or in control. Primal needs are urgent and illogical. So arguing them into a corner is just going to push your counterpart to flee with a counterfeit yes. And being nice, in the form of feigned sympathy, is often equally as unsuccessful. We live in an age that celebrates niceness under various names. We are exhorted to be nice and to respect people's feelings at all times and in every situation. But nice alone, in the context of negotiation, can backfire. Nice, employed as a ruse, is disingenuous and manipulative. Who hasn't received the short end of the stick in dealings with a nice salesman who took you for a ride? If you rush in with plastic niceness, your bland smile is going to dredge up all that baggage. Instead of getting inside with logic or feigned smiles, then, we get there by asking for no. It's the word that gives the speaker feelings of safety and control. No starts conversations and creates safe havens to get to the final yes of commitment. An early yes is often just a cheap counterfeit dodge. About 5 months after she'd told me to go away, I stopped by Amy Bondereau's office and told her that I'd volunteered at Helpline. "You did?" she asked, smiling with surprise. "I tell everybody to do that, and nobody ever does." It turned out that Amy had started her negotiating career by volunteering at the same place. She started naming people who were now mutual friends of ours. We laughed about Jim. In a sudden shift, Amy stopped speaking and stared at me. I shifted in my shoes as she gave me the pause. Then she smiled. "You get the next position." At that time, there were five other people aiming for the same slot. People who had psychology degrees, experience, and credentials. But I was on the road to the next hostage negotiation training course at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia, ahead of everybody else. My career as a negotiator had officially begun. No is protection. Think back to the telemarketer at the beginning of this chapter. The obvious reply to his question, "Do you enjoy a nice glass of water?" is yes. but all you want to do is scream, "No!" After a question like that, you just know the rest of the phone call is going to be painful. That, in a nutshell, distills the inherent contradictions in the values we give yes and no. Whenever we negotiate, there's no doubt we want to finish with a yes, but we mistakenly conflate the positive value of that final yes with a positive value of yes in general. And because we see no as the opposite of yes, we then assume that no is always a bad thing. Nothing could be further from the truth. Saying no gives the speaker the feeling of safety, security, and control. You use a question that prompts a no answer, and your counterpart feels that by turning you down, he has proved that he's in the driver's seat. Good negotiators welcome, even invite, a solid no to start, as a sign that the other party is engaged in thinking. Gun for a yes straight off the bat, though, and your counterpart gets defensive, wary, and skittish. That's why I tell my students that, if you're trying to sell something, don't start with, "Do you have a few minutes to talk?" Instead ask, "Is now a bad time to talk?" Either you get, "Yes, it is a bad time," followed by a good time, or a request to go away, or you get, "No, it's not," and total focus. As an exercise, the next time you get a telemarketing call, write down the questions the seller asks. I promise you'll find that your level of discomfort correlates directly to how quickly he pushes you for yes. My colleague, Marty Evelsizer, was the one who first opened my eyes to why no was better than yes. Marty was the FBI's crisis negotiation coordinator in Pittsburgh at the time. She was a dynamo and a negotiating genius, which earned her huge respect both within the Bureau and with the local police. But human beings are innately jealous, and her immediate supervisor was no exception to that rule. Her success diminished him, and that made her a threat. His jealousy got the better of him when the Pittsburgh Police Department's hostage negotiation team asked her to sit on the selection board for their new candidates. Picking her, and doing so over her boss, was an unprecedented move. So her boss decided to remove her from her position. For ignoring her regular duties, he said, but really it was for being a threat. When Marty sat down with her supervisor for her official dismissal, her options were few. He had every right to do as he pleased. Marty told me that she considered a variety of scenarios. She thought about going right at his jealousy and hashing it out, or explaining how the job would reflect well on the Bureau. "Would you like our office to be honored for its expertise?" But by the time she sat down with him, she had picked one of the most strongly worded no-oriented setup questions I have ever heard. "Do you want the FBI to be embarrassed?" she said. "No," he answered. "What do you want me to do?" she responded. He leaned back in his chair, one of those 1950s faux leather numbers that squeak meaningfully when the sitter shifts. He stared at her over his glasses and then nodded ever so slightly. He was in control. "Look, you can keep the position," he said. "Just go back out there and don't let it interfere with your other duties." And a minute later, Marty walked out with her job intact. When I heard Marty do that, I was like, bang! By pushing for a no, Marty nudged her supervisor into a zone where he was making the decisions. And then she furthered his feelings of safety and power with a question, inviting him to define her next move. The important thing here is that Marty not only accepted the no, she searched it out and embraced it. At a recent sales conference, I asked the participants for the one word they all dread. The entire group yelled, "No!" to them and to almost everyone. No means one thing. End of discussion. But that's not what it means. No is not failure. Used strategically, it's an answer that opens the path forward. Getting to the point where you're no longer horrified by the word no is a liberating moment that every negotiator needs to reach. Because if your biggest fear is no, you can't negotiate. You're the hostage of yes. You're handcuffed. You're done. So let's undress no. It's a reaffirmation of autonomy. It is not a use or abuse of power. It is not an act of rejection. It is not a manifestation of stubbornness. It is not the end of the negotiation. In fact, no often opens the discussion up. The sooner you say no, the sooner you're willing to see options and opportunities that you were blind to previously. Saying no often spurs people to action because they feel they've protected themselves and now see an opportunity slipping away. Since I've demystified no for myself, I've found the ideas, perceptions, and baggage that people have with that two-letter word to be fascinating. To me, it's like watching a movie or a music video from the 1980s for the umpteenth time. You can identify with the experience while simultaneously being conscious of the fact that the world and you have moved on. Today I coach my students to learn to see no for what it is. Rather than harming them or those they negotiate with, no protects and benefits all parties in an exchange. No creates safety, security, and the feeling of control. It's a requirement to implementable success. It's a pause, a nudge, and a chance for the speaker to articulate what they do want. As you can see, no has a lot of skills. No allows the real issues to be brought forth. No protects people from making and lets them correct ineffective decisions. No slows things down so that people can freely embrace their decisions and the agreements they enter into. No helps people feel safe, secure, emotionally comfortable, and in control of their decisions. No moves everyone's efforts forward. One of my grad school students, a political fundraiser named Ben Ottenhoff, drove home this lesson with a bang. For years, he'd been using a traditional yes-pattern fundraising script to raise money for Republican congressional candidates. Fundraiser: hello, can I speak with Mr. Smith? Mr. Smith: yes, this is he. Fundraiser: I'm calling from the XYZ committee, and I wanted to ask you a few important questions about your views on our economy today. Do you believe that gas prices are currently too high? Mr. Smith: yes, gas prices are much too high and hurting my family. Fundraiser: do you believe that the Democrats are part of the problem when it comes to high gas prices? Mr. Smith: yes, President Obama is a bad person. Fundraiser: do you think we need change in November? Mr. Smith: yes, I do. Fundraiser: can you give me your credit card number so you can be part of that change? In theory, at least, the yes answers built up a reservoir of positivity that exploded into donations when requested at the end of the script. The problem, in reality, was that the yes-pattern scripts had been giving poor rates of return for years. All the steps were yes, but the final answer was invariably no. Then Ben read Jim Camp's book, Start With No, in my class, and began to wonder if no could be a tool to boost donations. Ben knew that giving the potential donors a no-hard-feelings way to get off the call was going to be a tough sell to his grassroots fundraisers, because it goes against everything they had been trained to do. But Ben's a smart guy, so instead of totally swapping scripts, he had a small group of his grassroots guys test-market a no-oriented script. Fundraiser: hello, can I speak with Mr. Smith? Mr. Smith: yes, this is he. Fundraiser: I'm calling from the XYZ committee, and I wanted to ask you a few important questions about your views on our economy today. Do you feel that if things stay the way they are, America's best days are ahead of it? Mr. Smith: no, things will only get worse. Fundraiser: are you going to sit and watch President Obama take the White House in November without putting up a fight? Mr. Smith: no, I'm going to do anything I can to make sure that doesn't happen. Fundraiser: if you want to do something today to make sure that doesn't happen, you can give to the XYZ committee, which is working hard to fight for you. See how clearly that swaps yes for no, and offers to take a donation if Mr. Smith wants? It puts Mr. Smith in the driver's seat. He's in charge. And it works. In a truly remarkable turnaround, the no-oriented script got a 23% better rate of return. The only sad part of Ben's tale is that despite the huge improvement in results, he couldn't roll out the script to all his fundraisers. It went against fundraising orthodoxy, and longtime fundraisers like the fake comfort of the yes. Genius is often missed the first time around, right? One negotiating genius who's impossible to miss is Mark Cuban, the billionaire owner of the Dallas Mavericks. I always quote to my students one of his best lines on negotiation: every no gets me closer to a yes. but then I remind them that extracting those no's on the road to yes isn't always easy. There is a big difference between making your counterpart feel that they can say no and actually getting them to say it. Sometimes, if you're talking to somebody who is just not listening, the only way you can crack their cranium is to antagonize them into no. One great way to do this is to mislabel one of the other party's emotions or desires. You say something that you know is totally wrong, like, "So it seems that you really are eager to leave your job," when they clearly want to stay. That forces them to listen and makes them comfortable correcting you by saying, "No, that's not it. This is it." Another way to force no in a negotiation is to ask the other party what they don't want. "Let's talk about what you would say no to," you'd say. And people are comfortable saying no here because it feels like self-protection. And once you've gotten them to say no, people are much more open to moving forward toward new options and ideas. No, or the lack thereof, also serves as a warning, the canary in the coal mine. If, despite all your efforts, the other party won't say no, you're dealing with people who are indecisive or confused or who have a hidden agenda. In cases like that, you have to end the negotiation and walk away. Think of it like this. No, no means no go. Email magic. How never to be ignored again. There's nothing more irritating than being ignored. Being turned down is bad, but getting no response at all is the pits. It makes you feel invisible, as if you don't exist. And it's a waste of your time. We've all been through it. You send an email to someone you're trying to do business with, and they ignore you. Then you send a polite follow-up, and they stonewall you again. So what do? You provoke a no with this one-sentence email. Have you given up on this project? The point is that this one-sentence email encapsulates the best of no-oriented questions and plays on your counterpart's natural human aversion to loss. The no answer the email demands offers the other party the feeling of safety and the illusion of control while encouraging them to define their position and explain it to you. Just as important, it makes the implicit threat that you will walk away on your own terms. To stop that from happening, to cut their losses and prove their power, the other party's natural inclination is to reply immediately and disagree. "No, our priorities haven't changed. We've just gotten bogged down and..." If you're a parent, you already use this technique instinctively. What do you do when your kids won't leave the house, park, mall? You say, "Fine, I'm leaving," and you begin to walk away. I'm going to guess that well over half the time they yell, "No, wait!" and run to catch up. No one likes to be abandoned. Now, this may seem like a rude way to address someone in business, but you have to get over that. It's not rude, and though it's direct, it's cloaked with the safety of no. Ignoring you is what's rude. I can tell you that I've used this successfully not just in North America, but with people in two different cultures, Arabic and Chinese, famous for never saying no. Key lessons. Using this chapter's tools in daily life is difficult for many people because they go directly against one of society's biggest social dictums. That is, be nice. We've instrumentalized niceness as a way of greasing the social wheels, yet it's often a ruse. We're polite and we don't disagree to get through daily existence with the least degree of friction. But by turning niceness into a lubricant, we've leached it of meaning. A smile and a nod might signify, "Get me out of here," as much as it means, "Nice to meet you." That's death for a good negotiator who gains their power by understanding their counterpart's situation and extracting information about their counterpart's desires and needs. Extracting that information means getting the other party to feel safe and in control. And while it may sound contradictory, the way to get there is by getting the other party to disagree, to draw their own boundaries, to define their desires as a function of what they do not want. As you try to put the chapter's methods to use, I encourage you to think of them as the anti-niceness ruse. Not in the sense that they are unkind, but in the sense that they are authentic. Triggering no peels away the plastic falsehood of yes, and get you to what's really at stake. Along the way, keep in mind these powerful lessons. Break the habit of attempting to get people to say yes. Being pushed for yes makes people defensive. Our love of hearing yes makes